Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's so good to get reassuring news for a change. Like this week, I learned that there are more chickens on the planet than rats. This, according to the author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? It's an epic saga full of intriguing facts. For instance,
the chicken that we have today in America, 99% of the chickens that you can buy, whether it's in a McDonald's or an expensive restaurant or in Whole Foods or in some other supermarket, they all descend from the Chicken of Tomorrow contest. And as a result, the chicken that we have has large breasts and grows very quickly, but the downside is that it is often very dry and tasteless compared with chickens in other parts of the world.
Andrew Lawler, author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? Stick around. More's coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's a classic joke setup. Why did the chicken cross the road? Well, apparently the chicken didn't just cross the road, it crossed the planet. More than 2 billion chickens worth. Chickens outnumber cats, dogs, pigs, cows, rats, and us. They reside in every country but one and on every continent but one. Rebecca Shear talked to Andrew Lawler, author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization.
Hi there, Andrew. Good to talk with you.
Hi, Rebecca. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, so Andrew, before we get into the history of the chicken, something you mentioned in your book, which I think people will find pretty fascinating, there is just one country and just one continent that does not have any chicken. What is the country? What is the continent?
Antarctica is the only continent that doesn't have live chickens. Now, they do serve wings at places like the Amundsen Scott Station at the South Pole, but live poultry are forbidden because there's great concern that chicken diseases could spread to penguins. So that's the only place where chickens are forbidden. Vatican City is the only country that I could find in the world that doesn't have a chicken coop. It's just too small, and I believe that Pope Francis gets his chickens, because he likes skinless chicken breast for his meals, from the markets of Rome.
One of the surprising things you bring up in your writing is that at first, chickens were not domesticated to eat. That's only happened in like the last century. So what were some of the things they were used for before that?
Well, chickens, you would think, were domesticated for meat and eggs. But in fact, a lot of anthropologists today believe that the chicken was first domesticated for religious purposes and mainly for cockfighting. Cockfighting, like bullfighting, was originally a religious ritual that was performed between, say, two villages or two groups, two clans. And in the end, cockfighting became a very secular activity. But in ancient times, it was really for religious purposes.
Hmm. So what made the switch from religious purposes to, you know, dinner?
Well, people realized that there were many ways that you could use the chicken for everything from using its bones to sew sails, for example. The Polynesians did that. Or for tattooing, the Polynesians used the chicken for that purpose as well. As well as, of course, for medicinal purposes. The ancient Romans had lists of dozens and dozens of ways in which you could use the chicken to cure everything from bedwetting to insomnia.
Is it proven that chicken soup can cure the common cold?
It is. Your grandmother was right. Yes, a researcher who actually used his wife's grandmother's recipe discovered that if you feed boiling water to people with a cold versus chicken soup, the people with chicken soup actually get better faster. And now we know that there are certain elements in chicken meat which combine to ameliorate the symptoms of the common cold. But that's just one way in which the chicken can be used for medicinal purposes. For example, if you had a flu shot this season, that flu shot was made from chicken eggs.
Well, taking a look at the modern chicken we have today, I understand that Queen Victoria is the one who was responsible for that?
If you're to pinpoint one person who was most responsible for the modern chicken, it would be Queen Victoria. Back in the 1840s, she received a gift of several chickens from China. China at the time had been closed to the West. It was opened by force by the British. And one of the benefits of this was that the British got Chinese chickens. And Queen Victoria was so entranced with these beautiful birds. Now, keep in mind that at that time, English chickens were very small and scrawny and quite ornery, actually. But these Chinese chickens, by contrast, were incredibly large. They were very regal. They were very gentle. So the queen began to collect these chickens, and her court followed suit. And soon, particularly women all across the British Isles were paying large sums of money to collect these exotic-looking chickens. And this spread to the United States by the 1840s and 50s.
Now, the chicken that we eat in America today, how does that compare with the chicken that's eaten overseas?
Well, the chicken that we have today in America, 99% of the chickens that you can buy, whether it's in a McDonald's or an expensive restaurant or in Whole Foods or in some other supermarket, they all descend from the Chicken of Tomorrow contest. The modern chicken is actually a product of American science and engineering following World War II. So in about around 1950, the industry got together and they created this chicken, which has breasts large enough to be carved up into steaks and which can be fed a small amount of grain and produce large amounts of meat. This was a revolution because prior to World War II, chickens were actually fairly expensive and most Americans preferred pork and beef.
Wow. Chicken of Tomorrow.
The Chicken of Tomorrow contest. So most of the chicken that you can buy in the United States today descends directly from that contest. And as a result, the chicken that we have has large breasts and grows very quickly. But the downside is that it is often very dry and tasteless compared with chickens in other parts of the world. For example, I went to Vietnam to track the red jungle fowl, which is the original chicken, the wild bird. And while I was there, I visited several villages and ate a lot of the local chicken. And that chicken tasted radically different from what we get in the United States. It often was much moister, often quite oily to my taste, but it was considered a great delicacy there.
Andrew Lawler, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Andrew Lawler is author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? Rebecca Shear is host of WAMU's Metro Connection in Washington, D.C. Now, for one of our favorite global chicken recipes, head to splendidtable.org and take a look at Filipino-style adobo. It's simple and, oh boy, is it good. And while you're there, be sure to register for our monthly book giveaway. Check it all out. It's at splendidtable.org. We decided to do a tasting of California olive oils. Now, olives didn't have a good year in Europe, but California oils are doing very well. They may not be as familiar to us as Italian and Spanish oils, but I think they should be. So, first of all, there's a couple of things. How do you taste an olive oil? Well, it helps to know what determines taste. And there are, of course, many factors. For instance, how fast the olives go from the tree to pressing, because if they start to oxidize, the oil suffers. But there are two things you don't often hear about. The kind of olive, and that's often mentioned on the bottle. They go from the fruity, nearly sweet Abaquina to the peppery, even bitter Frontoio olive. And then, how ripe is the olive when it's picked? That determines a lot about what the oil is going to taste like. Green or unripe fruit, it's going to be brighter and tartar. And ripe, well, that's going to be buttery, kind of soft, maybe even dull. Now, you taste olive oils with water, never bread. That's how people sell the oils. Okay, now, I've got one oil right here. And the first thing you do is I'm covering the glass with my hand to hold in the fragrance, and I'm going to swirl the oil. This is going to kind of open up the fragrance. And then I partially uncover the oil, and I put my nose down into the cup, and I sniff. Oh, my. Okay, first of all, it smells like olive oil. But secondly, there's sort of a flowery, fruity overtone. Almost smells a little bit like tomatoes. Interesting. Okay, the next thing that you're going to do is slurp it. That is, take it in your mouth, draw some air over it, and that opens up the flavors. Okay, here we go. Oh, boy. Then you swallow, and you wait for the aftertaste. And this is called coffee, as in you want to cough. Wow, this is a peppery, aggressive oil. This is great on bitter greens. Mm. Okay, let's go to number two. I've got six oils here, by the way, all different colors. Okay, next one. I'm going to swirl with it covered. Uncover. Oh, this smells like fresh-cut grass. Very gentle. Very buttery. That aftertaste, you wait a few moments for that. It's still catching in my throat. Still a suggestion of pepper, but very mellow. Okay, now, a little water to clear the palate. And then number three. Cover it, swirl it. Very subtle fragrance. So on it went. I tasted my way through all six oils, and I'm ready to commit. Now, I have to say, all six of these oils are way above average. But this is personal preference, but I'd say if I had to pick only one, it would be number six. The aroma has a sweetness to it, and then you get this bitter overtone of artichoke. Okay, the winner is number six. And it's Katz's Organic Chef's Pick. And this is produced in California's Susung Valley. And they refer to it as a Tuscan blend. Now, usually that means it's a Frontoio olive and a Lecchino olive, and it has that peppery, kind of bitter edge. But in this case, the oil has that sweet fragrance, which means it would be really great with very delicate things. You could put it over grilled salmon, for instance, and it would be wonderful. And then it has that artichoke bitterness and a little bit of pepper at the end. And that would mean it's great with more assertive things. So, and by the way, talk about a tomato oil. This is a tomato oil. So Katz's Organic Chef's Pick. But you can get information on all of these beautiful oils. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the pinnacle scone from England's Boy Who Bakes and the man who created America's first Pinot Noir. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There was a time when if you had told a wine expert that there could be a superb Pinot Noir coming out of Oregon, you would have been laughed out the door. You probably know that today those wines are routinely compared to the great Burgundies of France. Well, one man started this off in the Willamette Valley 50 years ago. In 1965, David Lett did what many thought was insane. He and his wife, Diana, spent their honeymoon planting the first Pinot Noir grapes in the Willamette Valley. They were creating their Eyrie Vineyard, which now has cult status. David had a reputation for being a firebrand and a stubborn traditionalist, and of course, a visionary. He rarely gave interviews, but before his death in 2008, he invited us into his home, and we were thrilled. After all the success, the Letts still lived in a real house tucked into the vineyard with those original vines planted right outside the living room door. David was seated in a chair in the living room. His health had been failing, and he was tethered to an oxygen tank. Though he struggled at times, his eyes were bright and alive. His son, Jason, pulled up a chair and joined us. David, going back to those days when you were studying at University of California at Davis, which is, I always think of it as it's sort of the Harvard of wine, what were you drinking back then when you started to fall in love with Pinot Noir? Because we're talking the 60s, right? The early 60s.
Yeah, there were very few Pinots in California. So the curriculum was primarily based on French Burgundy. And that was my introduction to Pinot Noir, and that's what turned me on to Pinot Noir. They were ethereal. It evoked so much in yourself that it was truly an exciting wine to drink. And this was back in the days when Pinot Noir was made quite differently in Burgundy than it is now. Thank God. It was a nice wine. They're messing around with it a little too much in Burgundy these days.
So what you're emulating here are those wines that you were drinking early on, those ethereal, soul-touching, if I could coin a phrase, wines.
I am trying to. Uh-huh. But I've stuck to what I started with, and that is a Burgundian ideal of the 1960s.
You came here in 1966, and you planted Pinot Noir grapes. And you came here from California. You could have, in those days, gone anywhere with those grapes. Why did you pick Oregon?
Because I wanted to make the great American Pinot Noir. And I figured there was no climate cool enough in California to do that.
When did you bottle your first vintage?
1970.
Now, was it in 1975 that you entered the Pinot Noirs into a tasting in France? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes.
Jason, sure. I can help with some of the dates here. The vintage that was submitted was the 1975.
I see.
The year was 1979.
And what happened with that tasting?
It was amazing. We were in competition with a number of fine Burgundies on the first competition. Mm-hmm. And then Robert Drouin called a second competition, and we did even better. We placed second. I think Oregon was made then.
Drouin was a very famous maker of Burgundy.
Yes.
And he called that second tasting, why? Because you had done so well in the first and he wanted to disprove it?
That's right. Huh. Right on.
So what happened after this second tasting? What happened here? Did you suddenly have a market for your wines that you hadn't had before?
You're very incisive, yes.
But what was it like for you, personally?
Oh, I was dancing in the driveway. It was fantastic.
I've been told that this may well be the most difficult grape to grow, that it's called the heartbreak grape. I mean, it seems to be such a strange choice for someone beginning in the business, making his first wine himself, and choosing a grape that's so demanding.
Well, that was the fun part. Really was. Diana and I were talking a few months ago, and she said, "What would you do if you had this to do all over again?" And I said exactly the same thing. I'd do the same. It was fun. I was starting something new, and I enjoyed it.
What were the biggest challenges with that grape here?
Jason?
Every vintage is a new challenge. That's one of the great things about growing Pinot Noir. It's really expressive of vintage and of the person who makes it and of the place where it's made and, every sort of nuance that goes into growing that grape.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole new set of challenges every year, and that's what makes it so fun.
Were there out-and-out failures? I mean, did you have years where it was just impossible for you?
There was 1984, and that was supposed to be an out-and-out failure. Most people didn't even make Pinot Noir that year.
Uh-huh.
They turned it into rosé or something. And I stuck it out and made a red wine out of it, and it's delicious today.
We just had a tasting of every vintage we've done, all 37 vintages, and many of the people at that tasting picked out the 1984 as a favorite from that decade. And so that's a real testament to Dad's ability to adapt to, changing conditions from vintage to vintage.
So the way you make your wine, how do you make Pinot Noir?
Generally speaking, by keeping my hands off of it. I think the grapes are all important. I mean, they're the basis of the expression of the wine. Winemakers can go in and fiddle around and do this and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just going to bugger up the grapes. The best thing to do is leave the grapes alone and let them express themselves under proper growing conditions. We grow good grapes. Jason does a fine job. And he also makes fine wine, which is fortuitous.
I think one of the things that sets our process apart is how intuitive we are. That's certainly what I've learned from him, and that's one of the advantages of being a second-generation winemaker, using the word maker loosely. Is that I can work more intuitively because I've had the experience of working vintages with Dad and seeing the way that he responds to the environment. So I just try to do the same.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see the vineyard.
Absolutely. Well, let's go take a look.
Okay. Jason, I would imagine, did you teethe on a wine bat?
I teethed on a wine cork, that's for sure.
Really? Well, I guess that makes sense.
My kids have too, yeah. You know, my dad used to do a little game with us. He would buy a roll of Lifesavers, and he would hold a Lifesaver in his hand, and we'd have to smell it. And if we could tell him what flavor it was, he'd give it to us. But if we couldn't, he'd eat it.
So how many times did you get it right?
I'm pretty much 100% on Lifesavers now.
So we've got this slope up here covered with vines and the tractor back here that's waiting to do its work. But which vines are these?
These are Pinot Noir vines. And this block here is special to me. It was the last block that we planted at this vineyard. And I got to help do it in 1974. I was 4 years old. And if you look over to the hill beyond, you'll see the original vines, the ones that were planted in 1966.
And of course, they'll produce for a very, very long time yet.
Grapevines are a bit like human beings. You know, as they age, the quality of what they produce goes up and the quantity goes down. And so these vines will continue to produce fruit probably past their 100th year. And what we're going to continue to see as that process happens is an increase in quality and a decrease in quantity. And we're already starting to see this. This vineyard is giving us maybe a ton and a half to the acre every year, but the flavors are concentrated and gorgeous. And so we'll keep farming this long past the time an accountant would tell me to pull it out.
I like to hear that. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you. Good having you here.
That was David Lett, founder of Eyrie Vineyards, and his son Jason, in a piece that we recorded in 2008. Well, the British say scones. We say scones. But no matter what you call those British pastries served at afternoon tea, they're tricky little devils to make. And that's why our correspondent David Leet reached across the pond to talk with cookbook author and winner of the Great British Bake Off, Ed Kimber, a.k.a. the boy who bakes. They talked about the proper way to make, serve, and eat a scone or a scone.
Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mr. Kimber, can we please talk about scones?
So, was that a vague English accent there?
I thought it was pretty good. It's not vague. It's my Downton Abbey.
Kimber was good, but then you kind of trailed off.
I kind of fell off. Mr. Kimber. So, obviously, scones are scones. And
yes.
And you are the scones king, I would say. So, can you talk a little bit about where do scones come from? We think of them, obviously, as British, but where do they come from?
They are kind of definitely British, but there is a debate on where they traditionally actually originate from. So a lot of people will say they actually come from Ireland, where even people in this country would assume they come from the south, so either Devon or Cornwall, mainly because they're so associated with there. But there is also one other argument. There's actually a place in Scotland called Scoon Palace, which is where traditionally our monarchs went to be crowned king or queen. And because the name is exactly the same, it's said the same, there is a theory that they also come from there. But they are definitely seen as a Celtic thing. To the Brits, a scone is something almost kind of peasant food. It's very humble. It's very lightly sweetened, sometimes with nothing else in it, just a very light sweet bun, often with just some dried currants or raisins. So it's a very humble thing in this country. And it's just something very, very common.
Okay. And how about American scones versus British scones?
I would say the way I think of American scones is that they've taken the very humble British scone and they've kind of added elements to make it not better necessarily, but a little kind of richer and more extravagant. So with buttermilk and lots more kind of tasty ingredients like chocolate or blueberries or anything like that.
Whereas so we zhuzhed it all up.
Effectively.
When would you eat a scone in Britain? Your humble version of a scone.
It's definitely kind of an afternoon tea kind of thing. If you went to an afternoon tea at any hotel in this country, you'd be guaranteed scones. It would come with jam and clotted cream. It isn't something you necessarily have as a dessert, but it's not a treat either. It's something more every day. Because it's not that sweet and it's not kind of filled with heavy buttercreams or chocolate. It's a more light product.
And savoury scones, what place do they hold?
I think to Brits, scones are almost the same thing. They're stuck in their head as the old-fashioned, almost the classic. So savoury scones, you can find them, but it's much, much rarer. Apart from a cheese scone, you can find those in kind of supermarkets. But generally, you don't see savoury scones very often. It's more of a riff on a classic.
Okay. And you have a version of a savoury scone, don't you?
I do. I quite like the American-style scone just because it gives you a good flexibility and you can kind of almost put anything into it. So I do a lot with kind of cheese and ham, and you can put mustard in there. You can basically go, you know, if this sounds like it'll taste nice, you can put it in a scone. You can play around in all different ways.
I love the idea of mustard. A dry mustard, I'm assuming?
Yeah, you could use mustard powder, or you could add a little bit of, you know, English mustard, or French. You could add whatever you want, really. But yeah, a little mustard powder just with the flour would be delicious.
And then so talk to me about what makes a good scone, texture-wise, taste-wise, ingredient-wise.
They're so simple in ingredients. It would be flour, sugar, salt, butter, and then some raising agent, some baking powder. So really, really simple. And then just milk, maybe an egg. Egg tends to make it slightly richer. But for me, the key to the texture of a scone is it should be really, really light and tender. And that comes from how you make them. So I remember anyone who baked as a child was always taught by their mom or their grandma that to make a scone, you have to have a really light hand because you don't want to work the dough too much because it ends up making it tougher. To me, the way I learned to make scones originally was from my mom. It's how I started baking, full stop. I was on a show in the UK called The Great British Bake Off, which is actually just, I believe, just started airing on PBS.
Yes,
and
it did.
When I finished the show, I was very lucky to be invited to go and work in a kitchen in a restaurant called Le Manoir, which is a two Michelin star restaurant run by a chef here called Raymond Blanc, who's kind of one of those chefs to the UK who's been around forever. Everybody knows him, very well-regarded chef. And I worked in their pastry kitchen for a few weeks, and I learned a very different technique to how most people at home make them. So, you know, generally you would rub the butter into the flour, kind of if you're making pie dough, and you'd rub it in until it resembles kind of a breadcrumb mixture, which is the same. But you would then very briefly bring it together into a dough, and then you would stop touching it as quickly as possible and then cut out your scones. But the way I was taught was using a technique called chaffing, which I'm still not sure is the true word for it, but basically...
What is that?
Well, it's a type of kneading, but it's the lightest possible kneading you can do. So you're not stretching the dough, it's more of a fold. So you're trying to just incorporate a little bit of tension into the dough and also lots of air. And then you cut out your scones as you would do normally, but then you leave them to rest for about an hour. And what happens
It's
a hotel technique, so it gives you a different look. And what happens is, because you allow them to rest and you've given them this light knead, they start to ever so slightly spread and they get a rounded side and it looks just a little bit more refined. It's a slightly trickier technique and it goes against a lot of the rules I was taught as a kid and a lot of other people get taught as children on how to make them. But it gives you a very kind of professional, polished look to them.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Will you share the recipe with us?
Absolutely, yes.
All right, wonderful. Well, Ed, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Ed Kimber's blog is Boy Who Bakes. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Now, Ed gave us his recipe for a classic British scone. It's at, you know where, splendidtable.org. Coming up, we're checking in with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time for us to connect with you. Now, you can get to us any way you want, Twitter, Facebook, send us an email, go to splendidtable.org, or actually phone us, 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see, who have we got up? Adam's calling. Adam, hi, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Esther, Alaska.
Where's that? Where's that in Alaska?
It's just right outside of Fairbanks.
Ah, okay.
In the middle.
All right, now I've got a better mental picture of where you are. So what do you want to talk about?
Well, you know, I have a lot of us up here have a lot of salmon in our freezers. And, you know, it's some of the best salmon in the world, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And most of my stuff is from the Copper River. It's red salmon. And I find myself not wanting to mess it up. You know, like, I think it tastes great as it is, but then I get a little bit bored with just making it the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have suggestions that don't, you know, disguise the flavor.
Mm.
You know, I use simple stuff like olive oil, salt, and pepper. And then I have some alder smoked salt, which tastes amazing on the salmon. But I typically don't like to cook salmon with just a lot of flavor or a lot of fat, added fat.
Well, when you've got a Copper River salmon, fat is already in such wonderfully abundant supply.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, exactly. Well, first of all, just the simple act of rubbing it with a small amount of soy sauce and a little bit of sugar and some fresh ginger. Just make, you know, put that together, mince the ginger, mix it up with the liquids. Rub that over the salmon, put it in the refrigerator for about 30 minutes or so, take it out, rub it all off, just, you know, remove that.
Okay.
And then doesn't really need fat because of how lush it is. But then what I would do with that is I would sear it. I'm imagining now a fillet or a steak.
Yeah.
That's generally what you're working with, right?
Fillets, yeah.
Yeah, and this is a method for cooking salmon you're probably very familiar with. I learned about it from John Rowley, who is, in fact, he's the guy who brought Copper River salmon to the world. He was working on a fishing boat up in your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point is, you sear that salmon on top of the stove, very high heat, a little bit of oil, and then into a 200-degree oven. And you cook it really, really, really slowly. So it loses almost none of its juices. And that little bit of flavoring, that very subtle half hour, it could be an hour, of just flavoring it a bit with the soy and the little bit of sugar and the ginger, it just gives it another subtle element, another dimension. And you can use that in a lot of ways. You could do a paste of fresh herbs. For instance, one of the herbs that goes incredibly, I mean, it's beautiful with salmon, and you may want to wait for spring, but it's young basil leaves. And young basil leaves with onion or a little bit of garlic, salt and pepper, and you just rub that in and you let it sit on it for an hour or two and then remove it and then do the slow cook. Or put it on a grill, but always cook it very slowly so you keep all of those juices in it. Now, you know, if you want to start then having some fun with it and, you know, going a little bit beyond what you've been doing, one of the things to do is to cut it into squares or small bite-sized pieces, okay?
Yeah.
And then what you do is you do a stir fry. And that stir fry is wonderful if you've got something that complements the salmon, like snow pea pods or sugar snap peas or green, even scallions are wonderful with this. And water chestnuts. These are all crunchy things that have an element of sweetness to bring out the salmon's sweetness. And then something bitter as a contrast. It might be arugula. It could be something like even little bits of lemon rind in there. You know, just little shards of it. And, you know, take any stir fry recipe. The basic element of a stir fry is that you heat the wok, the oil, or the skillet. Oil goes into it when it's very hot. You do not heat oil in it.
Okay.
And then you throw something in the oil to flavor the oil. Often it's garlic and ginger or it's green onion that you swish around just for a few moments. And then you do, first of all, you do the meat. Or whatever the protein is. And in this case, it would be small pieces of salmon that you gently toss just until they're seared. They just want to sear. And you get that as hot as you can. You get that pan as hot as you can. You do not want to cook them through because the residual heat will cook them through.
Okay.
And they get put aside. Okay? And then You wipe out the pan, get it hot again, a little bit more oil, throw in salt, throw in whatever seasonings you want. And I wouldn't mind a little hot pepper in there because it's going to accent the sweetness of everything that you've got. And then in go the vegetables, and you toss them for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, but they have to be still crunchy.
Right.
And then the salmon goes back in to heat it up, and if you want to, you could add a little wine at that point, a little white wine. You could add, if you wanted, a tad of vinegar, which would be great. And then that's it. Your stir fry is done.
Thank you so much. You're amazing.
Well, no, I think your salmon's amazing. How long have you been in Alaska? Were you born and raised there?
No, I've been here almost 10 years.
And what took you to Alaska?
You know, I finished art school in Chicago, and I just wanted someplace fun and new. And I came up, and I had a great time. I still am having a good time.
That's fabulous.
Hey, yeah.
Think of us when you do that salmon, and we'll think of you with all that gorgeous Copper River salmon in your freezer. Good Lord.
Hey, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
All right, you too.
You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email. SplendidTable.org. We've got Suzanne calling from Long Beach, California. Suzanne, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, I have the gift from heaven.
I beg your pardon.
Well, I have a dear friend, and it's my birthday, so she sent me some caviar. It's salmon roe caviar, but she sent me a kilo of it.
Oh, my Lord. That's 2 pounds.
Hey,
happy birthday. What a present. Wow.
Well, I love it, but what am I going to do with over 2 pounds of... This is almost a half a gallon in volume-wise of salmon roe caviar.
Let me ask you something. How many people do you like that live fairly near you, that can get to you fairly soon? But really, I'm serious. Why not make a party out of it? I mean, yeah, you can put it on top of things, but this is fragile. It's not something that's going to last. And I don't know, freezing it, I think you'd end up with a lot of, unfortunately, broken up salmon eggs.
Just mush.
Yeah, exactly.
And the problem is once you open it, you have to use it.
Exactly. So I'm serious. You know, it's going to keep in the fridge for a day or two. But okay. Your whole deal here is you have a fabulous thing for everybody to share. And you only invite people who love caviar. What a wonderful birthday present.
Oh, isn't it great?
It's fabulous.
Friend.
Now, you do know, you know, you can mix it up with sour cream and a little grated onion, and you've got a great moussey kind of thing. That's one thing you can do with the salmon caviar. And it's also really lovely on top of anything. Just about anything but vanilla ice cream. But it's great on fish. You know, in some words, you cook whatever you want on the grill of any kind of fish you can think of, and then top that with the salmon caviar. And of course, I mean, it's just delicious. Well, you know, lemon, that's it. You're done.
I have a lemon tree, so that's good.
Okay. So I have a party.
Go,
be a purist. Go for
that.
It. I think you should. It's your birthday.
It is true.
Here.
All right. Well, I love your show and I love your books.
Thank you.
My husband and I listen all the time.
Hey, thank you very much. And happy, happy birthday.
Thank you. You have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bye.
Any excuse for a party. Fabulous. 800-537-5252. I got an email, and I have to confess, I can't remember the name of the guy who sent it, but he wanted to know what herbs to start now for summer grilling. Well, of course, you know the first one on my list is always basil, because basil is the best blending herb out there. It goes with almost anything. It's soft. You can't use too much of it. At least I don't think so. Okay, basil. And by the way, grow basil in stages, because it's best when it's really young, before the plant has even thought about flowering. The other thing is rosemary. Now, rosemary is a perennial. And once you get your hands, I don't grow rosemary from seed. I buy a plant, but you can keep that plant going for years. So you want rosemary. Thyme is fabulous. Also, if you're into chilies, you can grow your own. And I would suggest that you go for something like a poblano chili and some of the more unusual chilies. Okay. And then the other thing is you've got rosemary, thyme, basil, sage is just perfect. Sage and lemon, sage and lime, sage and garlic, sage and white wine. All of that is wonderful for Euro-style grilling. The other thing I'd probably be growing, if you could, is lemongrass. believe it or not. This is a Southeast Asian herb, and it grows in stalks, but it has the most wonderful, subtle, perfumed lemon aroma. And you chop that up and you pack it around pieces of meat, or you use it in a stir fry, and it has this lovely, lovely, lovely scent to it. Let's see, what else? There's so many herbs. I love lemon balm. Lemon balm is something I try to grow where I'm going to be walking past it and brushing it in some way because it has such a wonderful aroma, but it's delicious stuffed under the skin of a chicken or packed around a piece of salmon to flavor it before you put it on the grill. Another herb, and it's not one we normally associate with cooking, but it's really wonderful, is lavender. And it, of course, the aroma is fabulous. You can use it in so many ways. I just take branches and throw it in, you know, the closet where you keep the sheets, and it's just great. And it's wonderful steeped in cream to make a dessert. But one of the things that's really lovely is to cut up potatoes in chunks, especially the redskin potatoes, you know, those very firm potatoes, and then toss that with a neutral oil like a canola oil and lavender and a bit of onion and just put them aside for a couple of hours and then slow grill them. And you get the faintest hint of that lavender. So there's a few ideas for you. And you can take it from there. Oh, wow, how could I forget? Parsley and coriander. Fresh coriander. Absolutely fabulous. Also known as cilantro. And that's another one. You can use a great abundance of it. It's wonderful with ginger. So, few ideas. And thanks for a great email. Whoever you may be. Carrie's calling from Evansville, Indiana. Hey, Carrie, what do you want to talk about?
The other day, I was at the grocery store actually looking for duck, and I came across rabbit. And so I picked one up thinking that I'd like to make Easter bunny for Easter, but I have no idea where to begin.
I'm sorry. You remind me of a line from Julia Child. At one point, she was asked, do you think Americans will ever realize how wonderful rabbit is and, you know, how sustainable and all of that? Mm-hmm. And she said, not as long as there's an Easter bunny. So, anyway, I think you are very daring, and I think it's a great idea. Here's the deal with rabbit. Think that you're cooking chicken breasts.
Okay.
Because it tends to be lean. And it, you know, it doesn't have a lot of fat. That said, you can do almost anything with it. Now, okay. One recipe that I love, and this is something that I, from my experiences of traveling around in Europe, is slow roasting it as you baste it with a little butter and olive oil.
Oh, that sounds easy enough.
Yeah. And now what you can do with this is, I mean, because the rabbit's very delicate, and if you want to flavor it a bit, you do a mixture of garlic and rosemary and salt and pepper and a little bit of olive oil, so it's like a paste.
Okay.
And you rub that, and you can throw parsley in there too if you want to, fresh parsley. And the day before you're going to cook it, you rinse the rabbit, you pat it dry, and then you can cut it up if you'd like because it tends to cook. The loin of the rabbit, you know, the main body of the rabbit, mm-hmm. is really very narrow. I mean, the meat cooks quickly. And that you might want to take out before you take out the legs, for instance.
Okay.
So the point is, rub that paste all over the rabbit, loosely cover it on a platter, and put it in the refrigerator. The next day, when you're going to roast it, what you do is, first you sear it in a pan. Okay? Big skillet. Give it a good sear. Don't take the paste off if you can avoid it. All right?
Okay.
Or you can just put it in a roasting pan and put it in a 450-degree oven.
Okay.
Do
and
that.
How much do you cook it for each pound?
Well, you don't do it by the pound. You do it by the temperature.
Okay.
The internal temperature. Have you got a meat thermometer?
I do.
Wonderful. Okay. So what you want it to do is you want to cook it like chicken. You want it to get to about 165 degrees at the thickest part of the meat, which is usually the thigh.
Right.
And you're going to cook it really slow. So you're going to get it seared, and then you're going to start basting it with a little bit of butter. Mm-hmm. So you'll start out with a few pats of butter, you know, 2 tablespoons maybe. Mm-hmm. And you'll knock the heat down to just around 300, even 275.
Okay.
And you'll very slowly roast it, and you'll turn it, and you'll keep basting it with its own pan juices. After another 10 minutes in the pan, in the oven,
mm-hmm.
take about a quarter to a half a cup of white wine and pour it over it.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah. And then the next time you'd think about basting it, which is maybe another 20 minutes or so, a couple of tablespoons of olive oil.
Okay.
And
so
then
every other butter and olive oil?
Well, then what you've got is enough fat in the pan. Mm-hmm. You're going to baste it, another two times, just with the pan juices.
Okay.
And they're going to be delicious. They're going to be very aromatic. And once that and it's going to take time. It may take an hour, depending on how big is the rabbit? How many pounds does it weigh?
I don't remember, but it's not very big.
Yeah, they're not large. I would say maybe an hour.
Okay.
But, because you're doing very low heat, test it with the thermometer. And when it reaches about 160, 165, that's when you take it out of the oven and let it rest about 15, 20 minutes.
Wonderful.
Lightly cover it. Now, if you want to crisp it a bit, what you can do is just run it under the broiler. But I don't know. I like it when the meat's kind of juicy and tender and all those pan juices. And you serve it sliced or just in pieces, but with the pan juices. Test the center of the animal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's going to probably cook faster. If it's done ahead of time, just pull it out because you can warm it up again in the oven for a few minutes before you serve. Okay?
Wonderful. Thank
Low,
you.
This slow.
Wonderful.
Okay. Oh, I think it'll be delicious. Take care and enjoy it. I will love to know how people react at the table.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care, Carrie.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Carmen McRae. She said, "Blues is to jazz what yeast is to bread. Without it, it's flat." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. The Splendid Table is veritably overflowing with information. It's our 20th anniversary this year, and we're celebrating with giveaways and collections of our favorite things. Keep up to date at splendidtable.org. Turn to our podcast network, infiniteguest.org, to download podcasts of The Splendid Table, as well as Dinner Party Download, a fast and funny hour serving up culture, food, and conversation with other winning elements for a stellar dinner party. Dinner Party Download at infiniteguest.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.